We're joined this morning by Dr. David Kasserat, who is a highly respected researcher and professor of medicine. He's chronicling his exploration of the cutting edge of resuscitation and just how far science has come in this book called Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. Why did you term it as an adventure, Doctor?
Well, thanks. It's great. It's great to be with you. I tried to make it an adventure because I really I wanted to make it engaging and readable. I really wanted to write an account that people would want to read, even if they don't necessarily think about the science of resuscitation or the ethics of end-of-life care. I really wanted to write a book that was interesting, that was engaging, and, you know, honestly, I really tried to make it humorous. I tried to keep it light, and I tried to make it funny so that folks who normally wouldn't think about these issues would pick up the book and give it a read.
Well, resuscitation, how long have we as human beings been trying to bring back the dead, as it were?
Well, the short answer is probably a long time. There are certainly hints way back in ancient history of doing things like using tubes to help people breathe. But the real history starts probably in the 1700s, in two places, really, at more or less the same time, in Amsterdam, in the Netherlands, and in London, in England. And it was about that time, late 1700s, that two societies formed. These are societies that were made up of some physicians, but also lay people who tried to be more aggressive and more rigorous in figuring out how to bring back the dead. And so they tried all sorts of crazy techniques of resuscitating people, many of which I talk about in detail in the book. The list is actually quite long and really hilarious, actually, when you think about what folks back then thought might be a good idea.
Well, as it with anything, you come up with an idea and they say, well, let's try it. Nobody's tried it before. Maybe this will be the one that does the trick.
Exactly. And I think there's also an element that everybody knew that they were dealing with people who were, for all intents and purposes, dead. So there's definitely a feeling, as you read through some of these accounts, of folks saying, well, it can't hurt, so sure, why not? Let's try it. And so some of the examples are things like tickling people with feathers or beating them with sticks or rolling them back and forth over a barrel, putting their feet in boiling water. One of my favorites, actually, was taking drowning victims and throwing them over the back of a horse and then trotting that horse along. I tried that just to see what it would be like and to try to figure out why anybody thought it was a good idea. Confess, I'm not really sure. It was not a fun horseback ride, and I would not recommend that to any of your listeners.
Well, I guess part of that has to go hand in hand with determining when the person is dead. I mean, medicine has to get to a point where they have to determine. I mean, there is maybe, and obviously he hasn't moved for a while, must be dead, but there are people that may have some cause for that, but they must have had to determine this is death, so how do we undo that or bring them back from that then?
Right. And so there are technical definitions of brain death that we rely on now that have to do with brain function. So when there's really no meaningful evidence of brain function, we declare somebody dead. And so that's not easy, but that's relatively straightforward. I think the real challenge comes when paramedics arrive at a scene. I tell the story in the book of a story that made me think about becoming an emergency room doctor way back when I was on my way to medical school, a case of Michelle Funk, who was 2.5 years old when she fell into a creek outside of Salt Lake City in Utah. And she fell into the creek, was underwater for about an hour before she was found and pulled out. And the paramedics who arrived had a decision they needed to make. They couldn't, at that point, test her brain function. They don't have the equipment. They were by a stream in a park outside of Salt Lake City. So they needed to make some decisions not based on the hard and fast criteria of brain function, but they had to use their judgment. They had to make a best guess about what her brain function might be like if they were able to resuscitate her. And many people in those circumstances would have said, you know, she's been underwater for an hour. Nobody's really survived that long before. We should just tell the parents the bad news. But they didn't say that. They tried to resuscitate her. And they didn't just try. They tried for the next 2 hours. Every trick in the toolbox that they had, and then some, until they finally got her back after 3 hours of not having a heartbeat. And she survived after a long period in the hospital, went home, did well. And I heard when I was writing the book that she just got married a couple of years ago. So best wishes to her and her husband. But it's stories like that that make people wonder, well, you know, when do we give up?
The book is called Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. We're talking today with Dr. David Kasaret. You also talk about cryonics and the cryonaut. What is a cryonaut?
Well, a cryonaut, as I discovered when I went to visit a conference of cryonauts outside of Scottsdale in Arizona, I'm in the process of researching the book. Cryonauts are folks who sign up for a program. One of the biggest these days is run by a company called Alcor, which is based in Scottsdale, that for a cost of either $200,000 for your entire body or about $70,000 for your head, they will freeze you in liquid nitrogen and they will take care of you, in theory at least, until such time at which the medical science exists to be able to revive you, bring you back to life, cure whatever illness caused you to die in the first place, and restore you to society. So that's the promise of cryonics, and that's what many cryonauts either believe or at least hope for.
Must be something about a certain individual that's their answer, I guess. You talk about crowdsourcing resuscitation, and you have that story in there from just a couple of years ago about the 911 call where the woman did not perform the CPR. And you make a point in there where we as society have now been taking on the burden of bringing people back. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting change that's happened very quickly, actually. Not too long ago, CPR and shocks administered with a defibrillator were something that happened in the operating room or the intensive care unit or at most on hospital wards. But now a lot of people know how to do CPR. In fact, I tell the story in the book of learning to do CPR all over again with a classroom full of middle school students. So I watched and participated in as these middle school students learned how to do CPR. So now you've got seventh and eighth graders out there who know how to do CPR. And I think the most recent advance, which is both exciting and a little bit scary, is the creation of these automatic external defibrillators. Automated defibrillators that are popping up in grocery stores and health clubs and train stations and even on airplanes.
And workplaces, too. I have one here in our building, as I've seen. I've walked by it.
Yeah. So a lot of the advances, a lot of the improvements in survival are not due to high-tech stuff that happens in intensive care units. It's just the fact that chances are pretty good that if you have a cardiac arrest wherever you are, there's probably somebody nearby who knows how to do CPR, and increasingly there's a good chance that there's one of these defibrillators nearby with somebody who knows how to use it. It's almost getting to be the default that if you have a cardiac arrest, probably wherever you are, somebody will try to bring you back from the dead. That's not quite true yet. There's still a lot of people who don't know how to do CPR, and there are even more people, actually, who have the training but don't use it. I'm amazed at how many cardiac arrests are witnessed by people who are standing around but just either don't know what to do or know what to do but don't want to jump in because they're afraid of doing the wrong thing.
What about the future of resuscitation? What are we learning? I mean, you talk about a lot about the heart. The brain's a key component to a lot of this, too. What are we understanding or trying to implement in the future?
Yeah, one of the biggest advances in the science for resuscitation that I ran across, and one of the advances that was most exciting to me, honestly, was something that goes by a variety of names. Some people call it suspended animation. Other people don't want to call it suspended animation because that brings up visions of science fiction and space travel. And, you know, if you're a scientist studying anything, you don't want people to think of you as a science fiction nut. But the principle is really pretty simple, whether you call it suspended animation or artificial hibernation or hypometabolism. The theory basically is that in situations like a cardiac arrest or a motor vehicle accident or a soldier who's injured on the battlefield, in any of those circumstances, one of the big problems that's going to cause the most trouble is that your brain and other organs aren't getting enough oxygen. So the theory goes, maybe it's possible to trick the body into using less oxygen. What if we could trick the body and the brain in particular into going into a state that sort of resembles hibernation? When animals hibernate, many of them have metabolic rates that drop by 95% or more. So what if you could encourage the body and the brain of somebody who's just experienced a cardiac arrest to do that? Essentially, you extend that window of time that people can survive and do well without oxygen. And so right now, some of that work is going on with the use of cold and ice in the setting of a cardiac arrest. By cooling people, you can improve brain function when people recover. But what if you could do that in extreme ways? What if you could extend to a period of 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, maybe even a day, the time that people can survive without a heartbeat? That would be incredibly important. And it's not as far-fetched as it seems. I mean, there's been a lot of advances just in the last couple of years, and that's one advance that's very exciting and potentially something that could save lives soon.
The book is called Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. We've been speaking today with Dr. David Kasaret, who's joined us, who spent some time in Cleveland. We appreciate you sharing it with us as well. Do you still practice? Is this still something you do, or do you work on a more of a academic end of it now?
Sometimes it feels like I do a little bit of everything. No, I'm a hospice doctor. I'm a palliative care physician, so I see patients in the University of Pennsylvania's hospice program. And also, I also do research and teach, so a little bit of everything.
Again, it's called Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. Dr. Kasaret, thank you for sharing the time. Appreciate it today.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure. Thanks.